visual. So I understand there are some people who are much more visually oriented. They learn better when they have something like this in front of them. This is also something that you can hold on to. And as you do your own Bible study and you read of someone, you know, Ruth, what was happening during the time of Ruth, what was happening during the time of one of the kings or whatever it happens to be. To explain the scale, the numbers at the bottom, the dates there, they're consistent in that the large numbers are roughly 200 years apart until you get to 800 BC. And I had to open up the timeline between 800 BC and 600 BC just because there are so many kings of Judah and Israel. I didn't have enough space to fit them all in there. So I had to open it up a little bit so I had a little more room. But roughly, each of the gray vertical bars is roughly 25 years. So then, if you want to look at the key, the yellow box, the upper left, towards the upper left side of the chart, it says chart key. And so you have a description of what each of those color bars mean. The blue bars are either a patriarch, a prophet, or an apostle. White bar with red type is a major event. Green bar with white type is a historical event or ruler. Red bar with white type is a king of the United Kingdom. Gold bar there is a king of Judah. Yellow bar is king of Israel. So, and I have that disclaimer in there about historical dates can vary widely, and I've done my best to try to make it consistent at least. All right, so any questions on the setup? Before I became a pastor, I was a graphic artist for almost 26 years, so I created this because I like visual things too. To start out with, you've got roughly 4,000 BC there on the lower left side. There are many different debates of dates as to when the creation might have been, the creation of Genesis 1. 4,000 is a convenient date. As I said, you'll find many others. But we have right off the bat then these genealogies, and you see all those long blue bars. These are the names mentioned in Genesis, their length of years, how old they were when they had the first of their progeny. So you can see for Adam, it says, after 130 years, he had Seth. Now we know he had others before that, specifically Cain and Abel are mentioned. But when Seth is born, then Seth's life follows above, his son Enos follows above, Canaan follows above, Mahalalel follows above, Jared, so forth. You can see Enoch has a very short life compared to others pre-flood. And I have to wonder how common that was, actually. We look at those long lives, and especially Methuselah there, 3294 BC, longest recorded human life, 187 years old, he has Lamech, dies somewhere short of the flood. We're not sure when. Some think actually during the flood. Some think just prior to the flood. But nonetheless, we know he wasn't on the ark. But those long lives wouldn't necessarily have to have been the norm. Because what did Genesis 6 say about the pre-flood world? The thought of man was continual evil. And continual evil brings violence. Violence brings death. So anyway, we have these dates. Why do I have bristlecone pine there above Jared, 3521? I threw stuff in like this so you could just also get a perspective of things. This is how old the oldest bristlecone pine is estimated to be. It goes back to the time of Jared, pre-flood world. You notice at the top, north of 31, around 3000 BC, there's a yellow bar. It says 1/6 of mankind's history. So 1,000 years have passed by that red bar. And so we see that shortly after that, Adam dies. Adam lived himself to be 930 years old. I've often wondered at the heartache he and Eve felt at the decision they made in the garden, seeing what happened to all their descendants. But nonetheless, eight generations would have still had direct access to Adam and Eve. Eight generations. We're ecstatic when we have four that go back to the patriarch or matriarch. But then we have, of course, Lamech that is born from Methuselah, and then we have Noah who was born from him. And even Noah, it is oftentimes forgotten that he lived 350 years after the flood. And so as you pass the barrier of the flood, roughly around 23-25 BC, look who is still alive by the end of the life of Noah. You have Shem, you have Arphaxad, you have Selah, you have Eber, you have Peleg, you have Reu, you have Sarah, you have Nahor, you have Terah, and you have Abraham. Doesn't mean they all knew each other, but I have to suspect they did. Because as they sought to obey God, they would probably naturally kind of come together. Also, the population would not have been very large afterwards. It would have began to grow very quickly, but still, we think, and it talks about Abraham there in Genesis, it's almost like God plucks him out of obscurity. I don't believe he did. I think Abraham was simply a continuation of what we would call this righteous line. These individuals that obeyed and followed God, lived his way of life. If you follow that red bar at 2000 BC up, you'll see that I have the name Job with a question mark. We don't know when Job lived, but it seems that he was in that patriarchal time period because he was offering sacrifices for his children, which is what the patriarch did. Noah did it. Abraham did it. Later, that became a responsibility of the Levites for the people, but he was still doing that. Also, because of the names and the regions mentioned in the account of Job, it seems to put him somewhere in that time period. But again, the point is, in part, it wasn't just Abraham by himself. It wasn't just Job by himself. It wasn't just these individuals. Look at how many generations with Noah. You would have Noah, Shem, Arphaxad. So you've got 3, 6, 9, 12, 12 generations that would have known each other. But you also see the lifespans shorten up very quickly, don't you? So whether that was something God did genetically, there are markers on the ends of our DNA strands that seem to sort of be a terminal, if you know what a terminal is. In an electrical circuit, you put a terminal on it so the electricity doesn't go any further. You stop it where it is. Some of our DNA seems to have this terminal. It can only replicate so many times, and it doesn't. Did God do a terminal in our DNA, or did he change the atmosphere, or something else? We don't know, but he obviously said life doesn't need to be that long. The benefit of 900 years, what could you do with 900 years? There's a whole lot you could learn and do. I mean, you retire. How many projects do you have? You can never get to them all. The downside to 900 years is if you're not doing a good thing, you can do that for a long time. And so the evil, look at the evils magnified, how long it has to be perpetuated and spread. So God shortened life because he didn't need 900 years to see what someone's character is. 100 years is enough. And we don't. Most of us don't even have 900 years. Abraham comes on the scene around 1992 BC. And so then we start to see some of this other history. He married Sarai, his half-sister. Abraham was called out of Ur, which is very interesting. Historically, we know that Ur was destroyed somewhere around 1900. So shortly after Abraham left Ur, it was destroyed. Was that part of the reason why God told Abraham, you need to leave that area? I'm going to put you in another place. You see the various accounts there of Abraham leaving Haran, going to war, entering Canaan, Sodom destroyed. And then Isaac marrying Rebekah. You see Isaac's date there around 1872. We have civilizations exploding. To sort of back up a little bit, if we go back to around 2000, now we have a third of mankind's history, roughly 2,000 years. But you also begin to see history such as the unified Egypt. And Egyptologists, in my estimation, have every one of their dates wrong. And part of the problem is because of the way the pharaoh lineages overlapped. There wasn't always a clear delineation from one pharaoh to the next. Sometimes you would have a regent pharaoh, meaning the son would be king while the father was still alive. The king would sort of be training him. In some cases, you'd have even greater overlap. In some cases, you would have times where there was no pharaoh, short times. And so you'll have early dates, later dates, middle dates, if you want to dive into that rabbit hole. Even to the point of the Exodus that we'll come to in a minute. I believe it was around 1443. That date varies even within the church, depending on who you ask. But that date we derive from Kings, where it talks about Solomon and his reign and how many years since the Exodus. But you can see then how these pieces sort of fit together and how the civilizations start to come about, how the nations have developed. Genesis 10 even has what's called the Table of Nations. And it talks about these various peoples, many of which we can trace down to modern times, and so we know where they come from and where they are today. All right, so let's pause there. Any questions up to that point? Feel free to ask anything. I don't guarantee any answers, but yes, sir. Yeah. How do I reconcile those Egyptian dates with other history? And that's the problem. The historical records within Egypt don't always tie in with historical records of other cultures. And as a dominant empire, there's not a lot of recorded information from other kingdoms around them. So in a lot of cases, even historians are still making a lot of guesswork. And it's probably very good guesswork, but you can be off by quite a bit. For instance, if you ask a historian about the Exodus account, they will put it much, depending on how you view the term, later or earlier. Meaning it happened, well, let's just go to that. So the Exodus date of 1443, if you can find that on your chart, almost no historian puts it around that date. They'll put it much later, like 1200. Or even closer to 1,000. And they base that on a lot of assumptions, one of which is they believed that the Israelites were illiterate because they say they don't find much evidence of their writing. But recently, within the last 10 or so years, they have found a number of proto-Hebraics, essentially graffiti, on various blocks that were used in some of the buildings and things of this nature that have survived through time. So it's even a guesswork with the historians to a large degree. It's not until much later in Egypt's history that those dates can then be more solidly verified with other histories. There's also no unified calendar until we get down to the time, you know, of pretty much the Babylonians. And when you begin to have calendars that are recognized, and you can compare one calendar to another, and you can reconcile these dates. So that's the other problem when it talks about. When you get into the reigns of the kings, when it talks about, say, the fifth year of Pharaoh so-and-so, does that mean from when he sat on the throne, or from when he was regent, or from whatever date? They're not always consistent. And so that adds to the complexity of trying to decipher when these things actually took place. So it is patchwork. That's why I say I've tried to make it as consistent as I can. I'm probably off on a number of these dates, especially before the times of the early history of Israel as kings, their kingdom. Most of those dates are in question. So was it literally 2325 when the flood took place? Probably not. But at least you have a good estimate, and you can see the other events that are around that time period to get a flow of how things happened. Mr. Chance. Also, at some point, the solar calendar changed. Yeah, there's an interesting rub in here, because a lot of times, especially in prophecy, we read of 360-day years, which is a really interesting thing to consider. 360 is a really easy year, isn't it? 12 30-day months. You really don't need a calendar. Everybody knows. and every day is on the same day. You know, it just flows naturally. What if the pre-flood world was a 360-day year? And sometime post-flood, it changed to a 365-day year, which is very possible, because what happens when you put water on a spinning ball? It slows it down, which means you have more days in a year. But also throws off a calendar now, doesn't it? Because it's not just five extra days. It's 5 days, so many hours, so many minutes, so many seconds. Now it gets really wonky. Now you got to have all kinds of postponements and rules, and you got to add days at certain times and not add days at certain times, and it's a real headache. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Within 19 years, on what's called the Hebrew calendar, every 19 years, there are three. I wasn't sure if it was three or five. There are 3 years that need to be 13-month years instead of 12-month years. That's to account for the difference between a lunar year and a solar year. Now, you can't just add those whenever. There are very specific calendar rules as to when those are added. You add it too soon, now you've got Passover in the middle of winter. You add it too late, you've got Passover at the beginning of summer. It throws it out of their seasons. And that's one of the requirements, isn't it, in Leviticus. These are the feasts, and they're in their seasons. And so the calendar issue is another rabbit hole. If you want to get sucked into a thing that's going to just consume your life, calendar is one of those issues. But it's an interesting question, and that's another thing to answer your question. Were the years always consistent? The assumption from a modern perspective is that they were. But what if they weren't? Now you change all those dates before, and it changes everything, doesn't it? So again, this is a visual reference. Don't look at this as an academic go-to device. It's simply meant to show you how things fit together and approximately when they happened. Okay, so continuing on then, we get past the Exodus. They probably came into the land of Canaan somewhere around 1403. And they did so probably during the days of unleavened bread. That's a whole interesting story of itself. Joshua, of course, became leader of Israel. And so then you also have in these white boxes here, not just names of individuals at certain times, but for instance, 1446 to 1406, the first five books, the Pentateuch, are written. Now, obviously, Moses wrote from him, trying to think how to say this the best way. God inspired him to write Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy as it happened. Genesis was probably inspired and written from, compiled from, other sources. So, for instance, in Jude, he makes a reference to the book of Enoch. It's not the book of Enoch you can find today. That book is spurious, came around probably 200 AD, somewhere in that area. But God chose not to preserve it forever, but it was preserved for a time. And it talks about what Enoch knew pre-flood. Were there other accounts? That would have had to have been preserved somehow for Jude sometime around probably 50s AD, to draw from that account, to write his letter, when it probably happened, pick a date, some 3200 BC. That's a long time to preserve it, but what if there were other things? Where did Moses get the account of the Table of Nations? Where did he get the account of Nimrod? Where did he get the account of Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel? God inspired probably a great deal of that, but he may have also had sources to draw from. Bear in mind that a modern historical viewpoint is also an evolutionary viewpoint. And it's a very arrogant standpoint that pre-history man was ignorant. But I've watched enough documentaries and videos, and you probably have as well. When you look at the Incas and you look at the Egyptians and you look at some of these amazing cities that were built with tolerances we're just now able to achieve today. The Ark itself, we didn't replicate a ship of that size until the 1950s. modern-going ocean tankers are the same proportions as the Ark. They're very stable in open, rough waters, and they carry a huge volume with very little effort. Noah built it with wood. We had to build it with steel. Who was the better engineer? So that ancient history, from a historical perspective, is seen as ignorant. They didn't know how to write. They didn't know how to build. They didn't know how to do things they think we know best how to do today. And I think we've lost a lot of knowledge over the years, actually. Volumes and volumes. Anyway, so continuing on, we have Joshua. We have the period. Oh, let me just kind of highlight that. Down at the bottom above the dates, you'll see these different color bars. Starting at the left, pre-flood period, from 2325 roughly to about 1400 BC, a period of the patriarchs. And then following that, period of the judges until roughly around not quite 1200, a little past 1200 BC. Then you have the period of the kings of Israel and Judah around 725 exilic period after the exile. Persian rule, Greek rule, Hasmoneans. Hasmoneans were the Jews who ruled under the Greeks, and then you had the Roman rule. So those also help sort of differentiate some of these time periods, so you can better picture what was happening during that time. So under the period of the kings of Israel and Judah, you, of course, have the unified kingdom, first with Saul, 1048. Then you had his death, and you had David and Ish-bosheth ruling concurrently. David for the tribes of Israel, the 10, Ish-bosheth the 2, and then of course David ruling as unified king around 1001 BC. Did I say it backwards? Yes, sorry, I flipped those. David was king over 2, Ish-bosheth over the 10. And then, of course, then you have the dynasty of David, following with Solomon, who finished the temple around 937 BC. Then you have the succession of all these kings. And you have northern, after Solomon's death, of course, they fragmented with Rehoboam, Jeroboam, and all their successors. The northern tribes had about four dynasties. That's not indicated here on this map, but another chart that I did. There were about, I think, four dynasties, if I remember correctly, in the northern tribes. And, of course, the southern tribes had the one until their capture. It was all descendants of David. 721, you have the northern tribes fall to Assyria. And to even go back to one of the questions earlier, for a long time, some of these ancient kingdoms, historians didn't even believe existed. So whether it was the Hittites or whether it was some of these other nations, even the ancient Assyrians for a time, a lot of historians didn't believe the Bible was very accurate. And of course, over the last century or so, half or more, with archaeology, there's been abundant evidence showing that the Bible is very, very accurate and consistent with that history they're discovering. One of the curious things that happened, if you look in the middle, roughly above the bar line that indicates 650 BC, you see a white box. It says 600 to 400 BC, many new religions. And that's a very curious thing that happened during that time period. There was this explosion of religions. Prior to that, most of the world was monotheistic. Whether they believed in the one true God or not, they were mostly monotheistic. But around between 600 and 400 BC, you had Buddhism come in, Jainism come in, Zoroastrianism come in. You had the Greek gods that began to be codified. And, of course, the Roman gods came from the Greek gods. The exception to those were the Babylonians. The Babylonians anciently had this pantheon. But there were a lot of peoples who did not subscribe to the Babylonian gods. But after 600 or so, now you just have this plethora of all these various religions that many of them have perpetuated down through time. Then by 587 BC, you have the temple destroyed. Judah itself is taken into captivity, the southern tribes. Babylon comes on the scene. And of course, the prophecies that God gave that showed that Cyrus would restore the temple and some of those things of Judah. But pay attention to those blue boxes in there, all these various prophets going back to even 838. You have Obadiah, but Obadiah's ministry, if you will, probably overlapped Joel. Did they know Jonah? We tend to think in populations of a modern context, but that's not the case anciently. They also traveled more extensively than most modern accounts give them credit for. For instance, in the Roman world, when you're making a lot of brass, what's one of the prime ingredients that you need for brass? Copper. What's the other one? Tin. There is no tin in the Mediterranean area. When you want tin, you got to go to southern England. But that wasn't the only source of tin in the ancient world. There was also huge tin deposits in what is now Canada. There was also huge copper deposits in above the Great Lakes. If you go to the UP of Michigan, they have a long history of copper mines, huge copper areas in that area. And they traded with those areas. The Roman world traded. You go back to the accounts of Solomon, it talks about his ships leaving and coming back 3 years later. How long does it take to sail around the world? Roughly 3 years. You have accounts in South America, they expected what we would say white men. They expected white men to return. They had prophecies about them returning. Well, if they're returning, it meant they had to be there at some point earlier, right? And so you have these accounts that indicate there was a great deal of trade in the ancient world. So the stories that if you sailed too far west, you'd fall off the end of the earth. You know why those came to be? They're protecting trade secrets. They didn't want people going to North America and South America and getting these resources. They wanted to own them. So they create stories about, well, if you go too far, you're going to fall off the edge of the earth. And if people are not educated or superstitious enough or believe the gods are not with them, they're going to believe those things. And begin after time, it takes on its own life. But there's plenty of evidence Europeans visited North America long before Leif Erikson and Christopher Columbus and all these others that followed. So this I'm looking forward to knowing history when we can really know history. So you have, going back to the prophets, Nahum, Zephaniah, Jeremiah, Habakkuk, Daniel, Ezekiel, they probably all knew each other because their lifespans overlapped. And again, it's a small community, isn't it? The faithful of God have always been a small community. They would know each other. You have Malachi, Ezra, Nehemiah, of course, would have known each other. Ezra is credited in most sources having finished editing and codifying what we call the Old Testament. So that time period would have been around 480 BC. And he's also credited with 1st and 2nd Chronicles and Esther. 457, you have the 69 weeks prophecies. This is concerning Artaxerxes. And it gives us the indication of when the Messiah would reveal himself, 27 AD. Then you have Persian history that comes into play with Esther. I threw in names like Socrates, so you would get an understanding of when these individuals. Socrates had a great impact on Christianity, not as big as Plato. Plato had huge influence over what's called the early church fathers. When you hear that term, do not think Church of God, think Catholic Church. The church fathers began to interpret doctrine based on Greek writings, and Plato was one of their prime sources. So the immortal soul comes out of Greek pagan religion, not the Bible. Matters of Trinity. The Trinity doctrine is evident in just about every ancient major religion. Now, they can have a pantheon of other gods, but at the core is almost always a Trinity Godhead. Archimedes, 212 BC. Hannibal, famous story of Hannibal, almost conquering Rome, going over the Alps with the elephants around the end of the, beginning of the 2nd century, end of the 3rd century BC. So by the time we come to 0 BC, we're roughly at 2/3 of mankind's history. That's a lot of time that's passed. But you can see all that took place with the Persian history there, Antiochus. As the Greeks faded, the Persians came on the scene. The other way around. And then, of course, The Greeks were thrown off by the Jews that were in Judea at the time. That's Judas Maccabees. Judas Maccabees was of the high priest family, of that lineage, and they enjoyed a brief autonomy, not quite 100 years. And ironically, Pompey captured Judea by capturing Jerusalem in part because there was a conflict going on amongst the Hasmonean rulers in Judea, and part of them asked for Pompey to help them. And of course, Pompey, realizing once he helped them, there was no reason not to stay. And so they just assumed it into the Roman Empire, and they were so broken and really not equipped militarily that they fell very quickly to the Romans. And of course, then the Romans ruled that area for some time. They called it Palestine. Roman Palestine is what they called the area, which is why it's called Palestine today. The Palestinians have taken on that name and so forth. So it's just all this history that connects. So then you have Pompey followed in rulership of Judea, Herod the Great. Herod the Great was not an Israelite. He was an Edomite. This is in part a large reason why the Jews did not trust him, did not like him, because they did not see him as being the appropriate ruler for them, because he was a foreigner. Herod was a great architect. In terms of public works, he was unmatched in that area. But he was as despotic and as crazy as they come. So then Julius Caesar, you can see his reign, Augustus, Tiberius. Herod Antipas was the ruler in Judea during the time of Christ. And so then you see the blue bars there with Jesus Christ, John the Baptist, and some of the others. The white box above it with all the books of the Bible and the rough dates of when they were written. So that's the overview. Any other questions or comments? If you want a digital copy, if you go back to that chart key box, you'll see there at the bottom a copyright and below that an email address, DanielTDowd@Hotmail. If you want the digital format, send me an email. I will send you a link that you can download it. Just bear in mind when you download it, it's about a 6 or 7 gigabyte file, so it's going to take a while to download. Mr. Chance, did you have something? I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Nahor. Yeah, Abraham was the son of Terah. They were step or half. It seems, yeah. They don't have, she's not listed as having the same father, so there must have been the same mother. Yeah. So that was the lie, wasn't it? When they went down to Egypt, is this your wife? No, this is my sister. The truth, but a lie. That was a pattern, wasn't it? Yep. Okay, well, it was just kind of a fun overview. I didn't want to get into anything major. Thought about bringing some heresy and letting Mr. Hall clean all that up, but thought better of it. All right, well, I appreciate being with you all. Have a great rest of the Sabbath.